Good morning, folks. I don't always begin with prayer on this podcast, but today I think I will. I mean, prayer should come before these things, and it has, but let's just pray. Lord, we know that we can keep no secrets from you, that you see the innermost parts of our heart and our intentions, and that one day we will give an account. You also know that we love our children and our families, and we look round and see so many children who have no family and whose education system is driving the family away, not bringing it together. Lord, have mercy on our world and help us to show how a better way does exist. In your name we ask. Amen.
Amen.
My guest today is a bit like me. I've got a John Patrick. Which one is your Christian name, they say? Davis Owens has got two surnames, but if he took the S off, he'd have two Christian names again. So I've only just met him via Craig, who does all the technical work for this podcast. But he has a history of education, as I have, but at a different level. And we realized very quickly when we met yesterday online that we have a lot in common and we can be helpful to one another. So I'm going to ask him to introduce himself by telling you his involvement with education in particular and what other details he thinks might be important for you.
Thanks so much, John. What a privilege to be with you and look forward to having you on my podcast soon. It is a joy to get to know a fellow sojourner on this path of raising up the next generation and how do we do it well. I've been about, I think, 23 years now in the world of classical Christian education, both as a head of school and administrator, and of the last 4 years really working nationally with many, many schools that are starting, principally brick and mortar schools, but they're hybrid collaborative schools, there's homeschools, and I think after COVID, the world has awakened to this need for rethinking education. So I've had the joy of kind of helping to walk next to families and schools in that process. But my earlier journey, and I would sort of frame kind of my whole, I guess, life mission of, I've always had a passion for ultimately connecting people to the gospel, and looking at it through the lens of how do we contextualize the gospel to the cultural moment we're in. I majored in sociology, so I guess I kind of come to the world with that type of brain. I worked in local church ministry for about 12 years in suburban churches and city churches. And in the late 90s, I was trying to figure out, how do you do church in a world that is on the go and that most people show up for church an hour or two a week? And so it put me on a trajectory of trying to figure out, how do we, again, engage more deeply in the lives of people to actually make sure the gospel is, in fact, shaping our lives? And so, again, long story short, ended up doing a doctoral dissertation on using internet-based technology to build community, work for Christianity.com in Silicon Valley back in those days, then went and started a nonprofit with a former Disney Imagineer trying to look for creative, innovative ways to work with churches and parachurch ministries. But the whole time I've just been clamoring for, how do we connect people to the gospel in a way that will allow them to go deeply? And I ended up with my six-year-old in Atlanta, Georgia, and we were looking for schools, and I came across a classical Christian school. And I had some knowledge of classical Christian from the privilege of having studied at LaBrie Fellowship and watching Susan Schaefer McCauley, Frances Schaefer's daughter, raising her children back when I was a teenager. I was there and I noticed this amazing form of education taking place in the lives of young people who were articulate and winsome and well-read, and they were doing something different. And I learned it was a Charlotte Mason classical education. So fast forward, here I am in Atlanta with a young child, end up on the board of a classical Christian school, and I realized, wow, this is what I've been looking for, because it's an opportunity to have 16,000 hours between kindergarten and 12th grade to mold and shape the affections and the loves of young people. And I think it's perhaps the last best hope we have as a civilization right now is to be in the world of education. And certainly, ultimately, it's Christ that's going to save all of us. But how do we form day after day over those 16,000 hours the loves and values and affections, especially with so many competing interests around them in large measure technology, and we can talk more about that. But yeah, that's my journey. So my passion is, let's come alongside the next generation working with schools. And I think my most maybe urgent calling right now is helping millennial Gen Z families that don't have the family support and collective knowledge of what it means to raise a child well and in partnership with schools. So we can talk more about that, but that's a bit of who I am, and I'm on a great journey.
Thank you. That's very helpful to me. I should tell you that my most hated faculty in the university was the Faculty of Education. I think they have ruined the university, and the sooner we get rid of them, the better. And we do that very simply by simply taking away their credentialing power. They want to hold on to the education system because it's a way of indoctrination. That word doctrine comes back to us to haunt us, but we don't do it in the same way. My favorite line about children, I have 20 plus grandchildren, and watching them play around the farm, especially when they were small, one line would come back to me frequently. It's from Gerard Manley Hopkins, and he says, "Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in eyes and lovely in limbs, not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces." I think that's stunningly beautiful and stunningly wise. And then just this week in my reading, I came across in Mark, within a couple of chapters, twice, Jesus lifts a child into his arms to teach the disciples something important about you cannot come to the kingdom except with the innocence and simplicity of a child. Lord, help. That's the prayer when it's asked with real intent, not as a mask of, I want this, this, and this, but Lord, I'm out of control until you come. So the most important education event that I am ever privileged to watch, and the one that brings me to tears, is grace. When someone is taken from the kingdom of darkness and translated into the kingdom of light, right in front of your eyes, that is stunning to watch. My expertise, as many of you know, is dealing with severely malnourished children and spending many years working on that. I can go into tragedies of that sort and do triage. I don't get emotionally involved. We have put emotion far too high up the list, and we don't need to do that. And in fact, when we do it, it's counterproductive in my view. I love the line at the end of Pride and Prejudice, or near the end, where Darcy says to Elizabeth, having at last realized that they're in love, "You must have thought me devoid of all proper sentiment." Now, I was never sentimental, but except over animals and Grace later on, but I realized we're supposed to have proper sentiment. When they say you must show empathy, that's ridiculous. A method actor would ace that bit of the medical course. I mean, Cheryl Streep can persuade you that she's a whore one day and a saint the next. That's what they do, but it isn't real. But we don't show empathy because we can't, in a way. It's a gift when it comes, and it has to be taught that way. And my awakening to the importance of some more Christian content in learning came because the Africans asked me all the while, when are we going to develop? We spent many summers where the Rwanda revival began in the 1930s. There are people there who could remember dancing in the streets with joy when the gospel swept through that area in the 1930s. But move on. 60 years, and Christians ended up killing one another in the Rwanda war.
It's interesting.
The question was, how could we do this? And of course, the failure was to produce disciples. Now, I'm going to get back to Craig. If you take that view that Christ plays in 10,000 places, one of the most important things about teaching is when you get under the skin of someone. Now, obviously, for the very young, we have a need to put some things in place, but it's not very much now. Because if your child gets to the age of 11 and is numerate, literate, and polite, you're way ahead of the game. So you don't need to go mad. Some of the best people in the world in terms of educational example didn't learn to read and write till they were 10 or 11. But they were brought up in the story, so they weren't actually literate. They were numerate in the way that everybody is numerate, and they much more. And they believed. They were courteous. They lived in a community that they cared about and that cared about them. How much play is there in the classical school?
Well, I think it, you know, one of the, I think, challenges of even talking about classical and classical Christian schools is sort of what exactly are we talking about? We're not a, you know, I say we, but it's not a franchise. It's not a, you know, we're not the Montessori schools or the Waldorf schools. There's not a three-ring binder on the wall that you pull off and teach to it. So one of the challenges is sort of how do we find excellence and alignment around what are those core principles? And I would say to your point, I think probably one of the most urgently needed is a time for forming of the moral imagination and creative play and all of that. And I think as you look at sort of the rediscovery of classical Christian education, which many people would kind of point to the calendar of Dorothy Sayers' article on the Lost Tools of Learning, and then sort of the early 80s, the sort of the beginnings of new schools that were using this model. I always think in terms of there sort of being three stages or three, I guess, eras of classical Christian. In the early 80s, I think it tended to be more wooden, perhaps. It was, if you asked somebody to explain it, they would use the trivium, and it was sort of the frame of, around the child was the explanation. And then maybe by the 90s and the 2000s, we started talking more about trivium plus great books. And then I think the last 10, 15 years, there's been a shift more in the direction you're describing, which is it's really about the shaping of the affections or the loves, kind of back to Jonathan Edwards' idea of what are the affections. And unless we're trading in that currency of what they love, we're probably not going to really have a lasting effect. And part of forming a love is shaping and giving room for imagination, which is really, I think, in a world of screens, one of the great things that we still champion is like, let's read a book and allow the child's imagination to formulate who the character, what they would have looked like in their setting and all of these things that are done for you on a screen. So it's critical to the healthy formation of a child is the use of imagination.
Good. I'm also thinking in the modern world that playtime outside in an environment where teachers are watching at least twice a day will do an immense amount towards any nonsense about transgenderism, for instance. When you put boys and girls in a playground, they play different games very quickly.
We'll see who has more grass stains on their pants. Tends to be the boys from all of it.
Yeah. I think that's important. And what all the teacher's there for is to teach them better manners, better courtesies. I went to one of the best schools in England for my high school, but we had two full afternoons a week of sports. We did go to school on Saturday morning as well. But during those afternoons, whether it was athletics in one bit of the year, or rugby another, or cricket in the other, but particularly in the rugby and cricket, you had to learn it wasn't acceptable to sulk about losing. You learned how to be gentlemanly about it. Cricket in particular does that in an amazing way. Any of you listening who would like to follow that stream, get your hands on a little book by C.L.R. James called Beyond the Boundary. James is a Marxist in the Caribbean, but he recognized that cricket had civilized the Caribbean so that it doesn't have the problems that America has with the black population. Tom Sowell points this out, that they come from Jamaica and they end up like running your military, one of them, Colin Powell, or Colin Powell. They do have this thing about names. Cricket is important at that level. Something in life that civilizes instead of the absolute passion to win at any cost is not Christian. So that's an important lesson that you learn that way. And I see so many, particularly from the overachieving Asian backgrounds, where they really, I mean, you've got to be a doctor, a lawyer, or a businessman, so to speak. And they came here not because they were running away from a disaster, but because they were running away from economic disaster. But then they don't have they have a tin ear when it comes to these things like Christ playing in children. And there are many more. And twice in the middle of Mark's gospel, Jesus picks up a child in his arms to teach the disciples that he who wishes to lead must serve. If you don't have the innocence of a child when you come to me, you'll never get into the kingdom. Easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. I think that is the small gate and the big gate getting in. It was just possible to get a camel through, but only with unloading them completely. And the disciples said to them, there's no way. And Jesus says, there's always a way with Christ. And one of my questions to you is, do you have any guidance to those key moments which I don't understand? I mean, I spent my life in the university, but every now and again I meet somebody who can tell me something I said, where it was and why it was important. I have no memory of it, but it was very important in their lives. What do you have to say about that? The Faculty of Education doesn't even know that this exists.
No. Well, you know, you were commenting earlier about just, let me get around to your question this way. I often was a head of school when I was interviewing teacher candidates, actually, or before I even got to the interview, just going through resumes, if they had been to a mainstream progressive university and had a master's degree in education, it was almost assumed right off the bat this was not going to be a good fit for us at the classical school because of the radically different way that they had been educated formally. And so that was for sure just a flag that I think we both see the concerns there. I think that, it is kind of sobering. Somewhere along the way, I think I heard that, the average person remembers maybe 3% of what they hear and I'm not even sure I remember 3% unless it's within the first hour of a lecture or a sermon or whatever it may be, barring some kind of memorable story or an emotional connection to that moment. And I do think that that's, more of us would probably recall mentors and experiences that framed who we are and what we are about as much as some propositional series of truth statements or information, if you will. And I think that's, the old adage, we're much more interested in formation than information. It's a nice cliche, but that really is the heart of classical Christian education is. And I think, unfortunately, sort of we have a branding problem, which is classical Christian people are just softer boys and domesticated girls that want to sit around and play violins and read old dusty books and someday aspire to be librarians. Like, I think that's a really unfair impression of what we're all about. We're, in fact, trying to raise up young men and women who are, in fact, forward-facing and not probably, but I think highly adaptable and prepared for a very complex modern world, who can actually think. I did a podcast recently with a technologist and AI expert, and he said, honestly, everybody panics when they hear AI, but he was saying the reality is classical Christian students are probably going to be some of the few that are truly capable, having been trained in logic and the skills of rhetoric, to actually be prompters to write prompts for AI. So in other words, we'll be at the top of the technology curve, not the bottom, as classical people. So I'm wandering a bit maybe from your question if you want to reframe it, but I do think that we are involved in far more than just informing students with better books and better information. It really is shaping the very things that they love and care about deeply.
I agree with you entirely about a master's in education is almost a definition of what you don't want.
Exactly.
And we need to be able to engage them. Now, my favorite opening to engage them, I give you mine and see whether you have others to add to it, but it's from Wendell Berry, who is a dissident in good ways. But in his first Port William novel, Watch With Me, is a love story between a great Gorky farmer, Ptolemy, and a village school teacher called Miss Minnie. And this is in the days of the horse and buggy and the one-room schoolroom. And they're both unmarried, and they look at one another around the village, so to speak, and they both think, what a wonderful spouse he or she would make for someone. they don't realize that they are made for each other, and the story is about how they learn that. But in describing Miss Minnie, the teacher, Wendell Berry destroys the Faculty of Education in one sentence. He says, Miss Minnie went to teacher's college, where she learned many cunning techniques, which she never subsequently used, because Miss Minnie loved children, and she loved books, and she taught by merely introducing the one to the other. That solved for me the problem of 1 Timothy 3, that all the criteria for leadership in a Christian organization are character traits, not skills. I used to think apt to teach was a skill, and it bothered me because even as a little boy, I liked lists to be proper lists and to exclude, to categorize properly. And 1 Timothy 3 bothered me because apt to teach didn't seem to fit. And then I realized that you can't make teachers. That's why the Faculty of Education is a failure. Teachers are made by God, and they are the product of two loves. If you don't love children, you might be a decent teacher. You might force some calculus or whatever into their minds, and they're scared stiff of you, but at least they'll learn something. You're very unlikely to meet a Miss Minnie who loves your child and loves what she teaches. The vast majority go into teaching because they start by loving children, and then they're indoctrinated themselves because they're so childlike, and they lose that love. I mean, when you line up children and start undermining their most basic biological traits, which are currently already emerging slowly. I mean, the gender change occurs in utero, and it's all about whether your cells resist testosterone or not. I spent a lot of time doing metabolic medicine and some of these problematic children that they go to. They have no right to talk about them until they've dealt with them, because they are not evidence that trans is right. Those children never complain about their lot. It's amazing. I never heard them. They just wanted to get the most decent life they could get. Different world. But the two loves. Do you love children? Do you love learning? Show me an example from the teacher of their love of learning. What would that look like?
Let me back up one step and say, my own journey, I was a public school kid out of Atlanta, then I went to private college prep school. And then by the time I finally had that moment where I came in versus board member and then head of school in Atlanta, I've said that I was 3 years in before I could adequately explain what is classical Christian education. And in part because I grew up in a world that I think perhaps many still today we're all in this world, which is school equals reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's kind of schools are service providers in the minds of many, like grocery stores. You never expect your grocery store to be a place you would go and be spiritually formed, or it's just a utilitarian service, like picking up your dry cleaning. And I had this discovery when I began to understand what had happened in the last 100 years in America in particular, and really the hijacking of education by an intentional kind of progressive movement, starting with John Dewey and Charles Potter and others back in the early part of the 20th century. And to your point, the original, up until about 100 years ago, for centuries, education was, in fact, a teacher, with apprentices being mentored by this person. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. That teacher's character and nature and loves was contagious and effective. And I think in the 20th century, again, lots we could talk about here, and many have written about this, but really a hijacking of education using sort of a Prussian model of factory, which is we're going to line these kids up like widget. We're going to not only strip them of their ability to think creatively and have moral imaginations, we're going to basically form them into productive workers on the factory floor. We actually don't want them to think too much about things. We want them just to follow in lockstep. And now, of course, there is no neutral education. There's no non-religious education. There's a political indoctrination that's happening quite powerfully in the lives of young people. You were talking earlier about Rwanda. I've had the privilege of going to Rwanda four times and helping with classical Christian schools there. And it's interesting your comment about the revivals that were going on in the early 20th century, only to get to 1994, where a million people are slaughtered by their neighbors in 100 days. And there's a genocide Genocide Memorial Museum there in Kigali and in the capital city that was, you know, kind of very well put together, well funded, because they'd never wanted this to happen again. And it's interesting, as you walk in, the first display in large letters is, "How did this happen?" And then inside this glass cabinet.
Both sides were genocidal, by the way. And in another sense, neither were genocidal. As
right.
many Hutu were killed by the Tutsi as
the
Tutsi were killed by the Hutu. But the Hutu had to do it the Tutsi had to do it over a period of some time. And they chased people halfway across Africa to kill them.
Yeah.
And they haven't acknowledged that yet. They need to, because reconciliation needs both sides to admit their errors. Worse than errors.
You have a point in bringing it up, because I think it is. There's all kinds of egregious failures on both parts. But in this display cabinet is the curriculum, elementary school curriculum, in which the Hutus were reading that the reason that your crops are failing and you have all these problems is because of these dreaded Tutsis, and vice versa. But you just realize that if you can capture the imaginations and the minds of, especially starting grammar school, you can form. I like this saying, you form a love, you frame a life. And as these loves are being formed early, it really does frame up ultimately where that young person ends up being. And it made perfect sense to that 20-year-old that we were going to grab a machete and take out our neighbor, because that was formed in us deeply and early. And so, yes, I believe that the teacher there's no question. I mean, biblically, this is why the millstone principle, you mislead, you will have the millstone and you will be cast into the waters. I'm a big fan of Charlotte Mason, who is a British educator 100 and some years ago, who really was ahead of her time in terms of understanding neuroplasticity and the formation of the brain and the thinking. But one of the things that she makes such a strong point on is that education, it is the teacher, but it's really this mind-on-mind engagement of the teacher basically shepherding the child to these living ideas that are in living books, as she calls it, not twaddle, the pre-digested textbooks that so often are put before kids today. So again, a lot we could talk about there, but I think you're absolutely right that finding teachers that have a contagious love for their subject matter, and that realize that their job is not, it doesn't end with them. They're not the sage on the stage, but they're to introduce these children to living ideas that have transcended time, that ultimately are steeped in truth, goodness, and beauty, that then forms what our children love. So it's an absolutely vital task that teachers are given, and a critical objective of raising the next generation.
Now, when I came into the area of education, it was at the university level. I didn't care about the education system on the way through. Frequently, I was bored, but I knew what was necessary to pass the exams, and I was utilitarian in that sense. Meanwhile, I did have a life of reading. I learned to read very early because I was misdiagnosed and put to bed for a couple of months, basically, and I was about four. And my mother realized she'd got to keep me entertained, so she taught me to read. And by the time I went to school, I was way ahead of anyone else because I could read fluently. And that kept me going. Now, what happened is, it's a long story, and I'm not going to touch on it because I want to find out more about you. But the key step for me was being brought into contact with half a dozen other professors in the University of Ottawa, all of whom had watched young people come from the education system in North America. And I usually say, just to get under people's skins, they lose their mind, their virginity, and their faith in random order in the first year. Even going to Bible school doesn't help, makes them worse, because they come quoting key texts to people who are smarter than they are and better at rhetoric than they are, and they can take them down in public, and they maliciously enjoy doing it. They do not fear the millstone. We didn't know what to do. We'd all seen this phenomenon. So we actually read for more than 5 years. Once a week, we had a shameless two-hour breakfast, and we read everything we could find on the nature of education, from the Greeks to Alistair MacIntyre. What we missed in that, we didn't major on Deuteronomy 6. That came to me much later. So I think we have to ask people who are bringing their children to us, what is your use of the scripture at the dining room table? Because if it's not happening, the educational output will not be what you want. Because that's where moral consequence was learned. The Jews win because they have been, if they're brought up properly as a Jew, all the stories of the Old Testament are read to them by their father. Mother loves them and will tell them stories, but father is an authority figure. And his reading of the scriptures seriously, not didactically until they reach about the age of seven. I mean, they don't have the capacity to learn logic other than mechanically, but when they start asking how and why, that's the turning point. But by that time, you want a whole history of Jews and Christians in their minds. It's no problem for children. I was talking to someone the other day, the child not particularly overwhelmingly smart, but the child is functioning in three languages because grandmother's first language is Spanish. One is Francophone and the other is Anglophone of the parents. This is, and the child can handle them all. And you see that in Africa, where most African kids, yeah, they have their basic tribal language, which may be tonal, but they have shared languages, which are different, but they can pick them up very quickly. So that idea that there must be a narrative behind your life that is absolutely put there every day. So when I went to school in England, the Bible was read every day. The stupid thing that was done in North America was to take the book that gave meaning to Western society and caused America to flourish, and they took it out of school. Now, the person who lays into them best for this, of course, is Alan Bloom. He doesn't do it explicitly, but if you can read a text at all, he does it implicitly, especially in the first chapter. He said, I can't teach students who don't know the stories of the Bible. Why? Because all the metaphors come from there. Now, another thing you might do with your interviewing students, on my website, on the front page, I think there's a little green button, but you can find it. There's a test of biblical illiteracy. And basically, it's 50 or 60 phrases from the Bible, modified as they appear in English literature. And if you can't make the connection, you can read the whole sentence in the literature and miss the meaning entirely. Because the key is the biblical connection. I mean, in English poetry, I have to go and look at it. I've forgotten where it is at the moment. But the line occurs, eyeless in Gaza. Very good at the moment. Who is it? Now, not one in 100 people in church on Sunday morning will get that. But eyeless in Gaza, three words, brings the whole story of Samson into the poem, and all the disaster of his life and the final redemption, if you like. Our literature is full of such allusions which only Christians can pick up. So the British kept the Bible in school for cultural reasons. They said, if you don't know the Bible, and they would read the King James, because the precursor of the King James is what Shakespeare used. So you need that form of English language to understand and enjoy Shakespeare. Now, they don't have it, so they think Shakespeare is rubbish because they don't know what's going on.
Do I do anything like the emphasis on the Bible?
The test.
I don't do the test. I think that's a great idea. I mean, I could assume pretty quickly. I know, you know, one of the working challenges that you know, classical Christian schools, I think all Christian schools really have to think through is often called the three-legged stool in terms of the church and the home and the family, and how those three interconnect. And obviously scripture makes it pretty clear there is a biblical mandate for family and for church. And, you know, and so you'll get into these sort of jurisdiction wars sometimes, you know, in which the schools will kind of hold their hand up and say, well, hold on a minute, we're not the church, so therefore we're not supposed to be teaching this, and that's really the home. And then in the meanwhile, what I'm watching going on is churches obviously are losing you know, just time, if nothing else. I mean, like you, I grew up going to church twice on Sunday and once on Wednesday, and that's not the way it is anymore. So basic biblical literature, basic biblical competency is not there from the church. And so what happens is, we saw this at the school where I was most recently at, in here in Boise, Idaho, where you had students showing up into middle school, and there was an assumption, because of active scripture reading at home and at church, that there was a base level of understanding. And I'm sure if they took your test, we would all be quite distressed at the results. And so as the school, we had to surrogate a bit, and we introduced a Bible survey class into middle school to just make sure they knew the basics. Because to your point, there is, it is a base assumption that you have this biblical literacy. I always find it interesting to go back and watch old, sociologist to me, but even old sitcoms like I Love Lucy. And it's amazing how, if you listen on these episodes, you'll hear, even in this sort of silly little comedy, you'll hear something like a reference to a Herculean effort. And you're like, nobody today would even know what that means, because there's no reference to literature or scripture or, going the second mile. I laugh. Chick-fil-A talks about second mile service, and I'm confident that most employees have no idea that's a biblical idea of second mile service. So to your point, yes, I think we have a great deal of work to do. And I am increasingly championing the idea that our schools, whether we like it or not, are going to have to be in more of a surrogate role. And it's not to be dismissive of the partnership with our churches, but we have to realize that the average family today is highly distracted. The statistic I sometimes refer to, again, just emphasizing your point a moment ago about the need for the home to be a place of a spiritual formation, and the dinner table in particular. I love the idea of just, let's read scripture, and it doesn't need to be a sermon, but let's tie that into a habit that happens during the dinner hour. Statistic I came across was that only 7% of children who grow up and will grow up and profess Christ if the child is the only Christian in the home. That makes sense. It's that important. And then if the mother is the only believer, it's 36%. But if the father is involved, it's 90%. So, and I know you've talked a lot about that, but this is, again, I think one of my, I guess, the drum that I keep beating of late is like, mom and dad, you cannot drop your kid off at school like you drop your dry cleaning off to be laundered. You have to be involved. And there's no question the ultimate influence impact is going to be the home and the school locking arms together. Because if you look at a 24-hour period and you just do the basic math, they're in school 6 to 7 hours a day, and they are asleep, hopefully, 8 to 9, as well as I do, it's probably like 3 or 4, especially with technology. But my point is, like, the biggest influences are going to come during the time they're at home, the time they're at school. So we need to really encourage families to partner well.
Of course, the biggest time now is with neither school nor home. It's with the one-eyed monster.
It is with the one-eyed monster. That's exactly right. Yes, it is. And I am very much aware of that, and trying again, I think, to help. Maybe if, again, I'm making some broad generalizations, but I think a lot of times as classical Christian schools, we probably overestimate the influence that we've had. I think what we do is absolutely the best it can be, that 7:30 to 3 o'clock, or if you're in a homeschool, you maybe have your day divided up differently. But there's no question, this is the elephant in the room, or the cyclops in the room. And I think we've got to figure out pretty quickly, down, and it's not just, it's everything from, I always quote Marshall McLuhan in the 60s, who said, the medium is the message. I mean, I was talking to a young family just last week, and the dad was trying to make the case, well, we have iPads for our grammar school kids, but, the content is actually really good. And I said, that's not the point. I mean, that's good. That's better not having good content. But that flickering screen, as Todd Oppenheimer writes in his book, The Flickering Mind, is literally rewiring the way we engage our world. And the lunacy of having your child on a flickering device and then dropping them off at the classical school to go read a pictureless book, it's just creating this tremendous problem.
I would go to the library and read for 5 hours when I was a student and not noticed. I've heard students say in university, I got through this term without going to the library. And of course, Stanford has sold its library. It's all been digitized, so you don't need to go there. What has got lost in that process is all the things they cannot measure. The immaterial world has to be brought back. That's a huge problem. So when we started Augustine College, we didn't even want to give it subject matter in the sense of, We wanted an integrated course taught by people who were making their living in science or classics or whatever it was. We had to change that because even Christian schools wanted grades divided up as though subjects are part of a jigsaw puzzle, not part of a network. It's very sad that, and it's not understood. But unless you have an integrated understanding of what's going on, you become some kind of machine, not a person. I'm just reading at the moment Oakeshott's essays on education. I'm finding them difficult because it's beautifully written, but he's making cases that I'm not sure I even buy them completely, but he's talking about what happened to Jewish kids when they heard the Bible taught every day and it was integrated in every action of life. He's against teachers in many ways. He's about what teachers do, bringing people into an ethos of understanding. And we ought to recognize that that's got to be true at one level. You only have to ask the question, why did experimental science happen in Western Europe and nowhere else? I mean, the odd experiments were done in other places, but it only took off in one place. And I maintain the start, I got this from David Lindbergh in the University of Chicago, was when Aquinas was temporarily banned in 1277 because Greek learning was taking over the university and the Bishop of Paris was worried about it. So he banned the teaching of Aristotelian deductive logic. And that led them into inductive logic, which even the people who do history of science, they don't want to talk about this. Because when you think about induction, you realize cultures start from different bases. I had to go to Africa to find out why the work I'd done creating with others a protocol for the care of 10-pound two-year-olds, and it didn't translate. Because Africa is a newly Christian country in a fading pagan narrative of meaning. And if you believe in evil spirits, you have no means of even understanding an experiment. It's sheer idiocy. Different evil spirits, different outcomes. So for a pagan, the idea that an experiment done in London and another one done in Ottawa would give the same answer, that's rubbish. Total nonsense. But we're now facing neo-pagans in school. In fact, we're on our way to nihilism. We're currently at soft nihilism. Soon it will get hard. But it will mean it's impossible to teach some things. They will become unthinkable. And that's when a culture dies.
No, I think that is why it's imperative that parents are attuned to the what's happening in schools today. And I think this is why there's a rise in classical Christian schools, because especially since COVID, so many parents looked over the shoulder of their child on their laptop from the government school and realized, wow, this is not only the content that they're teaching you, but this is the way that they're teaching you. And maybe we need to rethink these things. And I think this is absolutely imperative. But to your point, the deeper understanding of education, which I think is a big step for a lot of us, that this is not just preparation for a utilitarian outcome to go get a job or get to a college, but it is the formation of every aspect of how we see and understand the world. And then the role of teacher changes dramatically in that. I often had the privilege for 5 years running to take our senior class through a trek through Europe as part of their senior trip. And we would do ancient, medieval, modern, going from Rome, Florence, Paris, and then to London. And I realized, you know, watching a lot of teachers, the debate was how much teaching is going on while they're going through this journey. So when they would walk into the Duomo in Florence, this beautiful cathedral, I saw teachers there with other students with binders, and they're sitting on the floor, you know, head down in the book, trying to get through all of the information boxes they were supposed to check. And I thought, this is such the epitome of modern education. They are trying to learn about a cathedral, and they're sitting there looking at a very dry factual information. And I thought, the last thing I want to do is that. So let me, in fact, prep them outside the Duomo, and then we'd walk in, and I got out of the way because I wanted to have a, again, a Charlotte Mason mind-on-mind engagement. I wanted the beauty and the splendor and the history to resonate and to move their souls and their imaginations without me, you know, squeaking in their ear a bunch of facts. And to me, that's a great image of the difference in sort of modern education and what we hope we're achieving through a classical approach.
One of my friends who is retired from the college at the moment, but Edward Tingley, you can find him on Patreon. He has a website called The Abandoned Schoolhouse. But he does an incredibly good talk on Chartres Cathedral because it's the Bible in stone. And we've only managed to understand this as cameras have got better and we could actually read what was high up. And my way with the medieval cathedral would be to say, what do you do when you go into church on Sunday morning, and how does it differ from what you do when you go into a Gothic cathedral? Well, of course, at church on Sunday morning, you're looking around to see what everyone's wearing and who's doing what, and it's chatter. You go into a medieval cathedral and your eyes are forced upwards, and your voice drops to a mere whisper. The building had a purpose, and it does it. Sadly, they're not used anymore because we've denigrated those purposes, reverence, worship. And most of all, what comes out of that, and you can find this in Psalm 73, beautifully put for students, but there is a crisis of trust in our society. Read Robert Fogel, an unbelieving Jewish Nobel Prize winner in economics from Chicago, who shortly before his death, a few years before his death, wrote a book called The Fourth Great Awakening. I had the privilege of meeting him and having a wonderful conversation with him because he realized way back around 2000 that he no longer trusted his students in the world's greatest department of economics. That meant they were going off to work for the government or the big banks, and they were more loyal to one another than they were to truth. They would destroy us, he said. I mean, in effect, 2000, he predicted the collapse of 2008. And he says the problem for all the students you and I teach is, can we create a network of trusted people for them? Now, at Augustine College, the fact that we haven't been successful in numbers does mean that we've created networks of trust. They keep in touch with one another afterwards, and we mustn't lose that. But parents have no idea what I'm talking about at this point, which is the sad thing. And hopefully, I realize we need you and you need us. And how we put that together, I am by no means sure. But I think you would find Robert Fogel's The Fourth Great Awakening. He looked at America and asked the question, why did America succeed? It had no development programs. So people who say, well, you haven't developed it. No, America didn't have a single development program, except that the people coming there all had a common story of belief. America is a Protestant country. It was formed by Protestants who were appropriate because a hierarchical church couldn't function in the 1770s. It'd take 6 months to get a message there and back. But congregationally organized churches could. So when de Tocqueville came to America to look at why America succeeded and its revolution had not been bloody, but his one in France had, he says, it wasn't till I went into the churches of America that I understood. America is a country with the soul of a church. That's still present in the middle and in all the smaller communities. New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles are not America. They are the default of America when the Faculty of Education takes over. They've not got a good record. Why they can't hang their head in shame, I don't know.
Well, there's no... think like Jeremiah, they no longer blush. I think all of that's been stripped, as you've described well. And that's, you know, again, there's no such thing as a
Where is that in Jeremiah? I've missed that.
I will have to pull the reference up for you.
I can pull it up too. I saw this one.
The people
that
no longer.
Through.
Yeah, I was. It's Jeremiah,
probably
but
a modern translation. But
it probably is. It's maybe I'm quoting the message or something here, but no, it's this idea of our nerve endings have been seared or whatever. I mean, you could think of it from a medical standpoint. We don't have that. We no longer blush. The sensibilities are gone, and I think those are that is the unfortunate reality. I often think about the friend of mine, Chap Clark, who taught at Fuller Seminary and. In the area of family and youth, wrote a book called Sticky Faith. And one of the points in there, we often cite this idea that, only 20% of young people who grew up in Christian churches and schools end up continuing in their walk of faith. To your comment earlier about all those things that explode the first year they get away. And the question is, well, then what he looked and said, well, why were the 20% going the distance? And one of the more memorable points he makes is what he calls the 5-to-1 ratio, that every young person needs 5 other significant mentors, heroes, voices that reaffirm consistency of faith and life. And so mom and dad are, maybe 1 and 2 of the 5. But the question I ask parents all the time is, where are you picking up these other 3 or 4 minimum voices that need to be there? And the reality, again, is that we don't monitor our heroes, and a teacher would be part of that. And I think the really scary thing is when you look at it today from a technology standpoint, and where, the question is, of any culture, where are its heroes? And when you look at the heroes of today, they're, it's not just, media, it's actually the influencers. We hear this term all the time, even a lot of kids today, they want to grow up and be influencers. They want to get on social media and make a scene, and then that becomes the new aspiration. So it really is, I think, a question of how do we monitor those 5 and the 5-to-1, because we're communal beings, we're sheep. This, again, sociology is always interesting to me. How do you take a young person, as you've studied this, and put them in an inner city environment without fathers, and then the next thing you know, they're wanting to go kill in a gang? Like that's not who that young person really wanted to be, but those were the rules of engagement. That was the currency that was being traded. So we can equally change that to something far more noble and aspirational if we put them in the right environment around the right mentors. So
I'm amazed how few Christians read Tom Sowell. And there's the perfect example of what can happen. A black guy who's one of the best academics in America, if he'd been born today, wouldn't have a hope of getting there from where he started. And he writes about it very well. I don't know what he believes. He doesn't talk about that. But my goodness, he's worth listening to. He can call rubbish rubbish. Now, at Augustine College, we reverse your statistics. 20% of our students lose their way that we know of. We wouldn't say there isn't a grey area in the middle. But well over 50% certainly are back in church at the end of university. That ought to be sufficient for people to be queuing up, but they're not. We're in danger of going bankrupt this year. COVID having closed us down, it's very difficult to get going again when you were drawing your students from so far. I mean, this tiny little college in Ottawa has had students come from as far away as Australia, Finland, Norway, West Africa, and the whole of this continent, from Florida to California to Vancouver Island to Newfoundland. That's pretty incredible. But we need help. But it's been lovely to talk to you this morning. I'm sure this is just the first of many, because we need to define many of these points rather more precisely.
Agreed that many... Well, and I'm looking forward to having you on my podcast, Basecamp Live. We can delve further into these things. But no, there's so much. This is such a critical topic for today, and there are so many elements of it that I would love to further explore with you. But thank you for your invitation to be here with you today, and for the great encouraging work that you're doing and the challenges that you're putting forth that I think we all need to consider. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been good for me. I'm old and curmudgeonly, so it's good to see the next generation coming along. Yeah.
This is what is amazing to talk with you, because I love the generational. We need better conversation across generations, which is one of the, that's a whole other topic we can take on, is sort of the dismissal of anything old. Yeah.
We have just had a wonderful discussion from the point of view of the two people talking to one another. We hope that you enjoy it too. Starting from Christ playing in 10,000 places to thinking about how that child will grow up with or without a Christian narrative guiding their life, depending on primarily what happens at the dining room table. Thank you.